you know, blank mechanical playing field on which forces, chemical forces, just were sort of mindlessly moving around everything at the mercy of the human being with his hand on the skid switch. Back in those days, Teilhard was saying, the universe holds together by the whole of itself. Cut one thread and the whole thing unravels. A message we still don't know how to hear. So Teilhard was to say, there is an intelligence that meets us. And then at the end, he took it to a step that sent probably 98% of his audience screaming in sheer terror. And he said that this planetary intelligence worked because it was not just some impersonal force of love installed at the heart of the universe, that it was a Christic presence. And his sense that what he named the omega point, which he postulated as the necessary point where lines that are converging have to converge. He then identified that with Christ and could come up with the mystical vision that he says that cosmogenesis has become Christogenesis. And you can take the image of Christ at the heart of the earth during the 3 days of the Easter Triduum. Teilhard doesn't really take it in that direction. He's more into our incarnation, you know, that Christ gets inoculated into matter, grows in matter, and finally possesses it as its own natural homeopathy. But it's Ladislaus Boros in The Mystery of Death who really takes this, that Christ at the heart of the earth doesn't mean, you know, some spiritual thing. Right here, you know, that to come to the foundational conditions that allow this world to be, and to essentially take the reins of them. We're talking about reins this morning in the carriage out. So that what is meeting us is not only a natural intelligence of a geobiospheric entity, but a person that has been revered, adored, in at least one branch of sacred tradition for qualities which have always been painted as cosmic, logoic, if you remember the word. So Teilhard, he makes that final knot, he ties it up only in the epilogue of the phenomenon of man, the human phenomenon. Says you don't have to do this if you don't want. It's enough if we can get you all to the idea that it's personal. And we're going to talk about that tomorrow. But his final ace up his sleeve is to play the Christ card and to say, this is what it's been, guys. That this evolution is under the sure and patient guidance of a one, a who, not an it, who meets you in your own who-ness and pulls it along. And we're going to look more deeply at how he comes to that tomorrow so that we don't leave it with, well, I believe it or I don't believe it. I want to see, because I'm going to, you know, working with some criteria that we've been laying out slowly this week, I'm going to say that he does not think that up. He sees it. And it comes from a different level of being in him. And in that sense, is to be regarded and received with a different order of veracity. that is, you know, this is not just an opinion of a Jesuit, a crazy Jesuit inflicted down. We're going to look at how he sees and how he tells the difference between when he's thinking and when he's seeing. But this one comes from deep lived revelation, which he tries to recount to us in the very last work of his life, written 2 weeks before his death, the Christic. So I'm going to spend some time there trying to go into that. And we will be looking at the more costly roots of Teilhardian optimism. But anyway, it does on the surface paint this picture. Well, Christ is in control, you know, and he had this beautiful thing that it all starts in a scramble in the unorganized, you know, multiple at that pole of atomicity. And then through the processes intrinsic in nature itself and in the shape of the geosphere, it moves along to about the equator. And things have converged to enough, consciousness has emerged enough, the species have emerged enough, that into that it's ready. That Christ can be inserted and manifest in the form of human being, go through the misadventures of the 30 years of his human life, emerge out of this at the Omega point, drawing things back. So, replete in Teilhardian cosmology is the sense of, it's okay. We're being met. We're being guided. And imbued in it is a sense of, for lack of a better word, grace. That something comes to us which is not of our own making or our own efforts. It doesn't mean that we don't pay for it. And we're going to look at some unsuspected sources in Teilhard's writing where we see, indeed, how much he paid for it personally and how much we pay for it. So we'll look at that again tomorrow too. But it looks like the story has a happy ending. And so that's the optimism. And as I said, one of the hard things about Teilhard is to discern when he's thinking and when he's seeing. And until you really have the map we looked at tomorrow with the levels of consciousness, and until you have some sense of the difference between, you know, waking sleep and some sort of sense of self-remembering, this distinction goes sailing right by you. And Teilhard himself didn't have a firm grasp on this. I mean, he's bungee jumping between the levels for his whole writing. And sometimes he's clearly coming from an extraordinary depth, from an aperspectival vision, and a power of the soul that can stay present to that. At other times, he's just essentially playing geometry and drawing consequences from thinking. And it's from that side of his presentation, you know, some of his ventures that are done at that more superficial level, and also that have not been received deeply enough in people reading and are already coming with their own projections, that account for the three major accusations, usually and sometimes correctly hailed at this so-called edifice of Teilhardian optimism. The first being, of course, that since he doesn't really reliably distinguish between thinking and seeing, he's got the glimmers of it for sure, but he doesn't stay with it. Some of his worst ideas grow out of a kind of glib statement that, you know, knowledge, intellectual pursuit is going to get us there. And so he will often, particularly in his writings, when he got back to Paris in the late 1940s and got involved with the founding of UNESCO and the whole kind of gestalt of the times after World War II, you know, he's fascinated that now that machines have been created that will allow us more leisure, we can use our leisure to do more science and gain more knowledge. And he sees scientists very often describes them as kind of hierophants, where we will go and make all these neat discoveries which will essentially improve the gene pool of humanity, so we become more loving, more conscious. And it was this train of thought, which is so clearly deductive, you know, two-brain, perspectival thinking. As Gurdjieff would say, the mental system just on its own. That we see often with, you know, with horror, what's at best glib, and is worst in our time so offensive that it almost gets him kicked out of consideration. And his the glibness in it's often some of those essays in his late time read like the old slogan of DuPont Company in the 50s, better things for better living through chemistry. And we know that Teilhard got fascinated by eugenics, you know, and we know he got fascinated by nuclear power, thought this was really a cool shape of the future. I had a kind of twig there that there may be something, you know, a little risky there, but was really intrigued. Many people have said, probably a little glibly themselves, that he foresaw the internet. But he had a tendency to confuse progress, meaning the onset of the next level, of the next structure of consciousness in human beings, with progress, meaning scientific advances along a linear timeline. And he tended very easily to fall into that and think that we were going to work our way out by cleverness, by new ingenuity. His newosphere, this new sheath of consciousness that he envisioned as hovering over the biosphere, is a product for him supremely of human culture. And in human culture, you know, he does not again distinguish between the levels. There's culture and culture. There's nothing like Gurdjieff this morning saying, oh, the artists, the poets, the literary people, all at the same level. Nor do we even hear vestiges of Gurdjieff saying that if there's the biggest oppositional force to consciousness is education. You know, Teilhard loves education, sees it as the faithful system of arteries and capillaries within the noosphere. Gurdjieff saw it as taking away that which was truly ours by essence and replacing it with a set of concocted formalisms of our own time. You know, half-truths, behaviors that were approved in the particular society we were in, squashing our essence under a sea of personality or personalities. And for him, this was precisely the loss that culture had. So So I think he and Teilhard and Gurdjieff would clash sharply on the value of the duosphere. And Teilhard's failure persistently to really distinguish the component threads of the duosphere along layers of consciousness really leads him unable to discriminate. And nowadays, in our sensitized world, guilty of some extraordinary howlers. You know, people will get onto his fascination with eugenics and come back and throw it in your face. People will get onto he was a white entitled patriarch and was skated a little too fast in his era to the collection of prejudices and misinformation that really created in its most distorted form Nazism. The whole idea of racial breeding, and of course with racial breeding you've got genocide right on the other side of it. And because he had such an image that we were moving towards something that he called the ultra-human, it sometimes gets too easy to get back into your scientific tech head and say, well, the way you make the tech the ultra-human is, you know, you breed out all the things that you decide are unacceptable or less desirable traits in a human being. And then somebody comes along who has a child with Down syndrome. Or as happened in some of the members of our own wisdom circle, a family member who was mildly retarded and became severely and permanently retarded with the family in the suffusion of idiocy in the early 50s, had this person lobotomized in an effort to improve her function. And with this family member comes across these glib writings of Teilhard on eugenics, you can imagine the result. And when a person of color at the Living School reads Teilhard's very clearly white, entitled, patriarchal, clerical perspectives unexamined, you can see why there are quarters of the Living School that say this guy is too out of date to read. And the other place where he encounters a lot of flack is in what appears to be his clear prioritization of Christianity among the world religions as the one that was the Darwinian survivor, if you want to put it that way. And you take him into a interspiritual conference where his work is otherwise well respected, and you get pushback because nobody knows what he's doing. It's definitely not polite in the circles we're in. Ilya Delio pointed out in sort of wonderful ways that Teilhard's attitudes about religion and his clear prioritization of Christianity were not coming out of prejudice, per se, but were coming out of some scientific criteria that for him, once he had already had the idea that the omega point was going to be most beautifully exemplified and manifested in a religion that could carry the gene and the image of that paroxysm of harmonized complexity, that could carry love in a powerfully intense dose and could connect it to the masses, that didn't avoid its embodiment, at least theoretically, but gloried in it, that could put it on the earth and not run off into some mystical stratosphere. He saw Christianity as the one who had the best possibilities to fulfill his evolutionary vision. And it's on that basis rather than any kind of natural prejudice, she argues, that his sometimes cutting and dismissive comments about the other religions are made, and yet they cause harm. His callous disregard for Sufis, his figures that the Jewish bucket was empty, these kinds of sentiments are so glaringly not on in our own time that his optimism, you know, his tendency to paint in broad brushstrokes and not discriminate carefully enough inside himself, where he was involved in this level of confusion, have come back to haunt him. Along with that, the other accusations frequently made against Teilhard are first of all that it becomes too easy to get into a dissociative stance in his work. The source of his deep hope is, of course, that we have to hold things on a longer timeline. That 10,000 years, 60,000 years is nothing in a geological age. And we can talk, as we just talked a few minutes ago, about COVID being the legitimate and lawful and expectable response to human metastatic invasiveness. And yet, for someone who's lost a beloved to COVID, you know, that's dark comfort. You know, how would it all be right in 10,000 years? You didn't get your marriage because your spouse, your betrothed, died. But it's all right, the planet's... You know, you can see how it feels. Whenever we set the perspective, the ratio out a little bit beyond the realm of what we understand the Percival to be, it can look like we're blowing the picture up so big that we lose the sharp edge of human grief and human suffering. And it feels like cheap comfort. It's always an occupational hazard when you take the big picture. And we still have to find a way to address the particularity of pain and individual suffering within the grand scheme that things are clearly staked at. So this is often held against him. And I believe it is, in fact, true that he was weak on personal sin, which is, of course, probably an overstated component of the Christian makeup, of the whole Judeo-Christian tradition. But it's a necessary one. And for Teilhard, being a good paleontologist with a view that went back several billion years, he could see perfectly well, that there could be no such thing as a primal fall coming from a sin from some primal parents. And my grandson Jack already knew that at 5. He said, which came first, Adam or Eve or the dinosaurs? You know, that the biblical myth was not an adequate explanation of the origin of sin in the planet. And so Teilhard was working actually brilliantly with the idea of systemic sin preceding individual sin. And without even giving it the name sin, seeing that because of the freedom and the nature of the evolutionary mechanism to play out as it wanted through trial and error, tâtonnement, as he called it, that there were going to be some dead ends and some monsters. And that Beatrice Bruteau picked up on that, the very thing that give us the evolutionary advances have their shadow side. The moment you make a cell which has a permeable boundary that allows there to be an inside and an outside and therefore an atmosphere, a baby atmosphere, you create a boundary. And it's, when you've got a boundary, you've got what's inside it and what's outside it. And her Beatrice's beautiful little dialogue about the roots of sin and the roots of differentiation, you know, are, you know, stunning. But of course, it was Teilhard's private questioning of Adam and Eve as an inadequate source for, you know, as incompatible with evolutionary history, basically, that was the decisive straw that got him exiled. You know, that it was a letter, and he didn't even write the letter in, he didn't give it as a public lecture. He was writing a private answer to a private correspondence about this question. And somebody apparently sneaked it out of his desk at the Institut Catholique and leaked it to a superior. And the rest is history. But I want to come back to this piece because I think it's clear and I think it's a legitimate and fortuitous, I mean, it's a telling criticism that Teilhard did by putting science and biblical history on a direct collision course in the Adam and Eve story. Basically drove the wedge into a schism that has a lot to do with the moral impotence in which we find ourselves today. He just did. And since we were already well into the prospectival age by then, linear thinking, logical causality, and one of the features of this age is that the differentiation between fact and fantasy grows very, very strong. As soon as it could be proved scientifically that this story could not possibly be true, the conclusion became then inevitably that it was false. Okay? So there we go. And as a result of this, we've seen the growing drift of our age to a shunning, you know, a distaste, a radical distaste for all manifestations of the old doctrines of sin, particularly original sin, that you didn't even get on your own merit, you came in inheriting. And a tendency to want to say, you know, these nasty people treated us as unworthy, but Lord, I bore thee. And a lot of people refusing to say, Lord, I am not worthy. I am worthy, you know. and that's the intensity of our era. But something crucial is lost here. And if you read Gurdjieff carefully, as we're going to read tomorrow, I would almost venture to say it's the linchpin is lost. So I want to come back to Gebster's structures. And remember how we said yesterday that these are not developmental levels? That was the terrible flattening that Ken Wilber did, that the magic and the mythical, when placed on that developmental perspectival trajectory, looked like more infantile stages. And as the new structure emerges, it replaces, it sets a new high water mark for consciousness. This is the whole kind of subliminal and not so subliminal message built into the, you know, the Ken Wilber flattening of the Gebser models. Gebser never said that. These are not steps on a staircase. These are structures which are valid slices, perspectives, into the whole of reality. And the Adam and Eve story does not belong in the middle rational structure. It belongs in the mythic structure. And that doesn't mean it's false. That simply is a rational retrojection back on, you know, using the simplicity that anything that isn't true is false and anything that isn't fact is. That what it does is it speaks to a participative truth. And it speaks brilliantly to it in the language of the mythical structure. And mythical consciousness is participative consciousness. You're not standing apart from things, looking on them clinically. You're in them. And what it's saying is that you, in yourself, bear a personal share of this. You do. And that the whole Adam and Eve story was not ever intended in that sense to be a rational cause, a scientific explanation of the beginning of the planet. But it is a moral and ontological, a moral ontology of the innermost essence of the planet. And there it points us to the fact that we do have a responsibility, and the responsibility has to do precisely with the indiscriminate plucking of knowledge. With the refusal to allow that which is ripe to be given, but out of curiosity, to grab. It's a very powerful story. And when we had the revival in Joseph Campbell and others, we began to pick up flavors of this. But we didn't get, I think we have not yet come back, because we're so convinced that these are infantile stages in us, and if they live in us, they just live in us as dreams gone by. To really say that, no, this story contains something that we dare not forget. It's a slice of consciousness that once we say, oh, well, that's just part of the old order, and we're on about where, you know, that our merry evolution takes us way beyond that stage, we lose something. Because we're going to see tomorrow that when we get to Gurdjieff, that the only chance for the planet, as he says, the only chance that human beings will wake up from their sleep lies in the stirring of them, of the still not yet completely extinct sense of objective conscience. If you tune in for the Beelzebub reading, we may get that far this afternoon. It's in the Asiata Shiamash passage, the heart, the chiastic center of Beelzebub. That objective conscience, that possibility still exists in the human being. But objective conscience consists, he says, of the remains of elements of the sorrow of our common father. I'm going to take this all apart tomorrow, so don't worry about it. This is a trailer. And that it lives in us and it touches ground in us as remorse. At one point in Beelzebub, he calls it the sacred ayo-ayo-ayo. And people laugh and say, what is this crazy word? Until you've heard the Jewish wail and all through the Near East, ayo, the lament of Rachel, the lament, the wail, that ayo-ayo-ayo. It's that cry of the heart of our own remorse. And when we're strutting around like happy little evolving egos, incapable of finding that place of remorse of conscience in us because we've outgrown it, we lose our connection, our one possibility to connect with objective conscience and to actually change things. So from this sense, the mythic structure is no myth. It contains the moral key that the absence of it and the continuing diminution of it in our culture for 500 years has again resulted in human beings, has everything to do with our species becoming the metastatic cancer in the planet. Because we have gone out of touch with our own remorse. And the story of Adam and Eve calls us unflinchingly to a remembrance of how this is real, not only somewhere else in the cosmos, not for other people, but for us as well. So, just a little bit about Gurdjieffian pessimism that I think I can maybe do in 10 minutes, if I cut to the chase well enough. That when you look at the world of Beelzebub, you get the sense that this whole idea of an onward and upward is balderdash. That the whole first book is structured around Beelzebub's six visits to the planet Earth. And they come at widely separated time slices in human history. So he's skyrocketing in on this, that, and the other. But he makes all the big turning points. Mm-hmm. And what he sees over and over again dashes all your hope that there's any forward progress. You know, every time he comes down, human beings are still up to the same old idiocy. You know, it's just variations. Nobody's gone anywhere. And the history revealed in Beelzebub is somebody gets the scent of something and they're doing okay for a while and then it all goes off track. You know, and he doesn't say it's getting worse, although he does lob some concerns that way about the human being. We'll get back and look at that more tomorrow. But it sure isn't getting better. If there's any progress, like all of us positives in the West like to see, I'd like to know where it is. But so his vision, and not only is it grim, but while human sinfulness is definitely ups the ante in the mix, it's not all entirely our fault. The first two strikes against the earth, this miserable, wretched planet, the tail end of the solar system, of course. The two strikes that were laid against it, the first catastrophes, were not in any sense human fault. They were cosmic errors, miscalculations on the part of certain cosmic individuals, which neglected to anticipate a cosmos or a comet straying into the Earth's atmosphere, which blasted the whole thing, sent two of the pieces of it off, knocked the whole thing off kilter, so that finally when it re-established its balance, a whole continent disappeared. So there was a lot of trauma, not of human making. But once we got on to how to participate in it, we did it gleefully. And even when the circumstances, when an opportunity was offered us to stop doing it, by that time we were too in our rut track to move. So there's error, miscalculation, and sheer bungling written through the whole thing, top to bottom, in the Gurdjieffian universe. It's not, well, human beings are uniquely bad. But the one thing that we would have to say about Gurdjieffian pessimism, though, that distinguishes it from traditional Sophia Perennis models now being touted forth in traditionalism, is that from Gurdjieff, you know, the human condition indeed seems to have lost the plot and is losing it more and more thoroughly, it seems, with each passing generation. But the way out is never back to a more primitive ideal society. The way out does not lie in going back to a certain point in origin where we lost the plot, finding out what the society was like back then, and reestablishing it. So it's very, very different from the mode you'll find in traditionalism. If any of you have worked with Lynn Bowman or some of that teaching, you get it. Oh, that there used to be societies, these old mythical societies were more perfect, that they were more advanced. You know, they rode on camels, they ate bread, they only played sitars, they only talked in myth. And if we could just be like that, we'd be perfect again. We'd be back on the plot. We'd have our old priest caste, and off we go. So the attempts to recreate our nostalgic version of the perfect society before it went off course, Gurdjieff never says that. He never once in Beelzebub points to a perfect society that stayed put. There's no place that you could come back to. That it moves on relentlessly. And he even has a sort of wry humor with the emerging bubbling cultures, I think the American among them. But for him, what happens again and again, his story is punctuated by when a whole planetary body loses the plot, how do things get back on course? And he gives you lots of little stories, but the two key stories are the story of the founding of the society Akhaldan just before the demise of Atlantis, and then the study of the Hashnavorti, I think that's how you say it, brotherhood around the time of Ashiatis Shiamash. And in both cases, the configuration is identical. A single individual wakes up with a question, looks at society, but more importantly, looks at himself, looks deeply into himself, and says, why am I asleep? Comes right up to this precipice we saw this morning. In the Atlantis, the society Akhaldan, it's a guy named Belkoltasi, who begins to be frustrated about the fact that he sets himself an aim and never does it. And he says, what goes on that prevents me from carrying out what I intend to do? St. Paul had that same question, but he didn't face it quite so courageously. No. But he saw it. So he called together a small group of individuals who were similarly interested in this question. And they formed a society of inquiry, that each one was given a part of the puzzle to investigate. What is it in literature? What is it in science? What is it in music that might be able to give us some information about what it is that blocks us? So they began to acquire a large amount of knowledge. But it was knowledge, not for knowledge's own sake, not information, but being knowledge. And they became learned beings, in Gurdjieff's testimony of it, simply to the degree that they applied the knowledge to bring about inner transformation and to get themselves over this hurdle. So they woke up. And once awake, a brotherhood becomes live. And Gurdjieff sees that in the seasons of the planet Earth, We have fallow periods, light periods, dark periods. There are times when the brotherhood and the streams go underground, and then, in times of desperate need, they come back up again. The Ashiat HaShemesh story capstones it. As he tried to understand what it is that was causing such pain and dysfunction in the human condition, and went back and through a period of intense preparation and inner purification, discovered that the faculty of objective conscience still remained in at least a vestigial form in a human being and could be enacted, and called together a small group of people once again that he began to train in the practices that might awaken them, and then sent them out in small groups to raise the being of other individuals. And in that way, as the being of the society gradually increased, they were able collectively to get over that hurdle and awaken. And then the outcome changed. So there is not in Gerty's vision ever a going back to a point in time, an earlier point in time, which was more ideal. Nor, as in Teilhard's vision, glibly interpreted, a mad and automatic march towards a future that's going to be golden. It always happens when human beings get off the timeline, when they get off the past and future, and instead encounter, through the lack in themselves recognized in remorse, encounter a different dimension of possibility. Discover the aperspectival universe which allows this planet to emerge in a different way. And you can see that set up in the book and never really getting there, but implicit in it, is that Gurdjieff clearly sees his own work as a third Ashiat HaShemesh, his work to try to raise the being of people. So the absolute linearity and mechanicality of anything that happened on that horizontal timeline was still possible. That we might be able to blast off it just enough to create a new possibility. Because neither past nor future will save us, but only this other dimension, which is a dimension which can only be grown within the individual soul by growing being, and then out of the sharing and magnification of that being, changing the outcome. So we're going to look at that more tomorrow. Tomorrow is the Remembrance Day of October 29. It will be a subject to look delicately at the insides of things. Why Teilhard's optimism actually has a good deal more aperspectival insight at Plato's suffering in it than at first meets the eye, and why Gurdjieffian pessimism is lined with the deepest and most tender sense of abiding loyalty and presence to this condition. And through that, an implicit faith in the future. We're going to look at that a little bit tomorrow. The question for tomorrow is really, how does love become real? And we may not be touching that directly, but if things go well, that will be the dough on which everything, harmonizes. Okay, so this evening, questions, comments, reflections on the day, some music, some preparation for tomorrow, at the evening and the morning, or the third night? Mm-hmm. Fourth night. Mm-hmm. Those count. Anyway, thank you. We'll see you. Those that want to read Beelzebub, it's 5:45 that we do it. And Amy and Deb, I'm meeting you to look at tomorrow a little bit more. Okay. I'm thinking Andrew, maybe, should Andrew be a part of that conversation too, since the music, you want to come to
us? Yes, he just wanted to tell him what.
We can order you around, or we can invite you to dominate a meeting. But we're going to be meeting over in Amy's in a couple of minutes to get on top of what passes for the structure here. May we stop? Let the thinking go. Come back into balance. Come back into your atmosphere. Good. Now, one last thing to announce before we break is that we have a book table. And we have a book table on which you will find copies of three of my all-time bestsellers, you know. We have a few Eye of the Hearts, if anybody doesn't have one yet and wants to get it. We have the series of essays and blog speeches, Love is the Answer, What is the Question, that Northeast Wisdom published a year or so ago. And we've got Ladislaus Boros' magnificent The Mystery of Death. So if you don't have them already and want to pick them up, what a deal! All books, $15. You can put cash in the little plater basket, which will shortly be forthcoming out there. You can write checks. Checks for Eye of the Heart go to me personally. The others go to Northeast Wisdom, if you can remember that. Or you can see Laura and give her buddy. So that will be sort of right in this table out here. Avail yourself as you want. First come, first served. I'll sign anything you want signed, except your checks.
Could you mention the foreword?
Pardon?
Could you mention the foreword in Mystery of Death? I don't know.
Oh, yeah, I wrote the foreword in The Mystery of Death.
You know. It's an extensive
foreword. It's an essay. It's just came out like this year.
It's a 40-page essay, which is really a commentary on Christ at the Heart of the Earth and Boros's take on this. So it's a little piece of Teilhardian's scholarship, for which I discovered exactly the same thing that Teilhard did, that the Jesuits were not interested. You had to publish it by other sources. But it's published. Okay, thank you. On to whatever your appointed chores are.